we plan to do today, in case you have something else you'd rather be doing than being here, if we're not going to get to the bill that you are here about. Today we are going to be hearing House Bill 3186, House Bill 2112, House Bill 3078, House Bill 2591. We are going to carry over House Bill 2621, House Bill 2002, House Bill 3107, House Bill 3284, House Bill 3077, House Bill 3321, House Bill 3242, and House Bill 2568. We are having a public hearing on House Bill 3078. The others are work sessions, so I'm going to start with the public hearing on House Bill 3078. I open a public hearing on House Bill 3078. Steve, would you please give us a summary of what this bill is about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3078 establishes a lead poisoning prevention educational program in the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. And we have Mr. Hughes. Is there a witness?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, here today representing the Pacific Northwest Paint Council. The Paint Council is a group of distributors and manufacturers that manufacture, of course, paint and coatings throughout the Northwest. We have something like 32 plants, warehouses, 32 manufacturing plants and 22 warehouses. We have about 1,800 employees that are involved in the manufacture of paint and coatings in Oregon. We bring you this bill today for a little discussion about lead poisoning. I handed out a question and answer sheet that I thought might be of interest to you. Questions that you would ask me, hopefully, and the answers that should be adequate. The bill simply help out Oregon's behind a national effort. We have introduced a bill similar to this around the country. Most recently in Florida, passed a childhood lead poisoning bill last year and funded it to $600,000 in general funds. We do not have this in the governor's budget. In Oregon, it would probably be a $150,000 to $200,000 budget because, as you know, Florida's 12 million people. We're 3.5 million people. You can see the legislation focuses on two very important steps that must be taken. First, it requires the distribution of literature about childhood lead poisoning to better inform parents and others so they are made aware of the risks and how to prevent them, and requires targeted testing for lead poisoning of at risk children under the age of 6. Both of these points are important steps and have shown to be cost effective and to dramatically improve the ability of families to protect their children from the very preventative disease of lead poisoning. The industry itself has stepped to the plate and introduced these bills around the country to show our efforts and concern regarding lead poisoning. What we are doing personally as an industry, we spent $75 million in the last 3 years on education, training, warning labels, training paint contractors on how to deal with lead poisoning. Why is the state's problem to fix a mess like this that the industry created? That's always a question. Good question. Because it's a public health problem. I suspect it's not as big a problem here in Oregon as it is in older states in the United States. But it's a problem nonetheless. And we'd like to maybe have the department discuss what they're doing and raise the level of information about childhood lead poisoning. That's why we introduced this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes, and also thank you to the industry for stepping up on this important issue. And Mr. Hughes asked and answered many questions. Are there any that you would like to ask, committee members?
Is the department going to be testifying on
this
bill?
Yes, they are.
No, thank you.
We knew they wouldn't like the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hughes. Next, we have Gail Shibley from the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonamici and members of the committee. I always forget to hand. Gail Shibley, Administrator of Environmental Public Health for Department of Human Services. We are extremely concerned about lead poisoning and in Oregon, and that's why we have had, for about the last 15 years, a good complement of efforts and programs to focus on childhood lead, focus on lead-based paint, safe handling of lead-based paint, train and certify contractors and painters. We do enforcement of residential handlings that are not safe on a complaint basis. You've got in my written testimony there that we have, unfortunately, agreed to disagree with Mr. Hughes, frankly, for a few reasons that are outlined there. We certainly don't want to dampen any enthusiasm or concern or effort to get the word out. It's frankly one reason why we're here today, and we appreciate the opportunity to kind of be on TV and be before the committee and otherwise talk about how important lead-based paint is in terms of preventing lead poisoning. Mr. Hughes is right that Oregon, thankfully, the poisoning, known childhood poisoning of lead is less in Oregon than it is in some other states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and some other states. We have a series of federal grants from several different sources to really deal with this issue. And in addition to the duplication and the redundancy and kind of the overlap of this, certainly as well as unfunded additional activities. We are concerned about some policy shortcomings in this bill, and I just want to draw your attention to just a couple. One, I think it's on page 2 of the bill as they're going through the definitions. It specifically excludes any owner-occupied housing, while what we have found in the last 15 years of doing this work is that on-site investigations, exposure to lead-based paint from renovation and painting accounted for almost half of all the cases, and among those cases, more than three-quarters of them lived in owner-occupied housing. And so to exclude owner-occupied housing is really not getting at a pretty significant part of the concern, the public health concern in Oregon. Second, the definition of affected property is only rental property, as I said, built before 78, but doesn't include rental housing stock between 60 and 78 unless the owner has actual knowledge of the presence of lead-based paint. That may seem terrific and common sense. We are concerned, of course, that this will discourage owners from testing their rental properties, because if they find out that they do have any lead-based paint, then they have to do something about it. But as long as they don't test and they're not quite sure, it's not verified, then they don't have to do anything. And we're concerned about what that might mean in terms of exposure for young children. And third, the bill specifically excludes what we know are significant lead paint hazards that are present often in soil or other surfaces of non-residential areas, pump houses, sheds, garages, and so forth, as well as non-living areas within the residence itself, including basements, for example. All of these and we know from firsthand experience in Oregon, that these are significant lead exposure routes for children. So we appreciate the focus. We appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of what we're doing. We'd be happy to provide additional information to you. We just simply don't support 3078. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shidley. Any questions for Ms. Shidley about this?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd just like to make a remark is that, I've been here for, this is my fourth term, and we keep working on this issue, and haven't been a victim myself of lead poisoning and other severe problems. And I just want to compliment the Pacific Northwest Paint Council for bringing this. I am so grateful that they would, on their own, do this. And so I'm going to ask you, don't you feel that, we have a difficult time in getting something perfect, but don't you think this bill, in the meantime, while we're working on getting something perfect, that we ought to move forward with this bill? Can't hurt anything.
Sure. Vice Chair Bonamici, Vice Chair Nelson, I wish I could say yes, but the answer is no. It actually will reduce some of what we do. It will land on top of other things. And frankly, we don't think it's effective, and it will exclude, as I mentioned, specific known areas of concern and priority for us. I want to mention, for example, the labeling that Mr. Hughes mentioned. We're very happy to have worked with. We work very directly with his group and others. And so now, when you buy a can of paint, there's information there right at the point of sale. It's those types of efforts. And while clearly any incident of lead poisoning is one incident too many, and I'm certainly sorry to hear about your personal experience with that. This, frankly, just doesn't add any value. If it did, we'd be having a different discussion.
Just a quick follow-up, please, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Could you please show me where it excludes those people you're talking about? I'm trying to find one that says.
You, Vice Chair Nelson, let's see if I can. Hold please. On page 2, let's see. This is a carryover from page 1. This is section 2. And you see on line 21 of page 1, it says affected property, quote unquote, does not include, and then number A is if something is not used for living, sleeping, eating, cooking, sanitation, then that's excluded. Following on the second page, on line 4, a unit that is not offered for rent. So if it's not offered for rent, then it's owner-occupied, it's something other than non-rental. And while we don't want to exclude rental properties, don't get me wrong, that's only a slice of the appropriate target. Is that responsive to your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it is, except I don't interpret it the way you do. So we'll just go on.
Thank you. And thank you for being here and for giving us this opportunity to talk about these important issues. I hope that the DHS continues in its efforts, and I don't want to disappoint you too much, but you said you appreciated the opportunity to talk about this on television, and I hope you reach a wider audience, perhaps those who are watching.
Thank you. Every Oregonian is good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Gilliam.
We have low ratings.
Thank you, Ms. Shively, for being here. I just want to ask you a couple of quick questions. I am not an expert on this issue, but I wanted to just clarify two things that I think you might know. One, is it primarily or only the way children can ingest this is by eating it, or should you be affected by it, ingesting it?
Vice Chair Bonamici, Representative Gilliam, that's a terrific question. Thank you. I thought I included that in my testimony, and I apologize if I did not.
I'm sorry.
It is certainly the primary. It is certainly not the sole. And it's not only by eating. It's inhalation of the dust. Oftentimes, you know, when you renovate a home and there's, you know, wonderful renovations happening, you know, in these wonderful old Oregonian homes, the scraping and so on, the dust gets down on the soil. Kids love to play around the soil. We're just as concerned about that as well. So it's dust as well as, you know, kind of taking a bite out of the windowsill.
Sure. And I'm going to follow. And I'm also interested, is it, it's true, we don't make lead-based paint anymore in this country. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Bonamici, Representative Gilliam, it depends on what your definition of lead-based paint is. It is the as defined by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the federal regulatory body. That is correct. Every quantity of paint has some very small amount of lead still today. The progress we have made came in kind of two different chunks. The first was, I believe it was 1960, was the approved or allowed level was reduced significantly. I'm not going to remember the numbers off the top of my head right now. And then in 1978, it was reduced to where it is today, and it is significantly small. Perhaps Mr. Hughes can give you that number. I'd be happy to find out and get that to you as well.
That's helpful. I appreciate it.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else here to speak about this bill?
No.
Well, I'll now close the public hearing on House Bill 3078. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2112. I'm now closing the work session on House Bill 2112.
What do you want to do instead?
We're going to do this another one first. We're going to go out of order here. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2591. And we have some Dash 1 amendments that came in. Okay. So we have some Dash 1 amendments, and I would like someone to explain the Dash 1 amendments. Would that be you, Mr. Ario?
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, Insurance Administrator, Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to speak in support of the Dash 1 amendments. They are amendments that we worked with Representative Buckley on. We gave him a number of choices for what could be done with the total loss issue, and these amendments reflect his choice as to a preferred route to try to reduce the problems with total loss cases. very quick context, total loss is the highest single area of consumer complaints for us. We regularly get more than 100 complaints a year in this area, sometimes several hundred. There are no panaceas in this area. I don't think anything we do will eliminate the problems with total losses because, as we saw at the original hearing on this bill, almost everybody has a very close affiliation with their car, and they think it's worth more than it is many times. And so I think you're always going to have some difficulty with expectations here. The question is, can we make the system better than it is today? And we believe that the Dash 1 amendments would be an improvement. It would achieve a more transparent process for total loss resolution, and it would rely on public sources of valuation as the starting point for valuations. I'll talk about what the bill does very specifically and then be happy to answer questions. And I do know there are some people who disagree with the Dash 1 amendments here today as well. In Section 2, the intent of Section 2 is to say that when the insurer decides that a car is a total loss, they should start with one public source. And we define that in two ways in the bill. One, that it's a source that is not primarily a for whom the clients are not primarily the insurance carrier. So we're looking to sources like Kelley Blue Book, like NADA, which is the Kelley Blue Book is primarily used by banks to do valuations. NADA is an auto dealer's source of valuation. And then Edmunds is increasingly used by consumers who are trying to figure out what their car is worth when they're going to buy one or what they should pay when they're going to their car is worth when they're going to sell it and try to figure out what a car is worth when they're going to buy one. So those are the kind of public sources that do not rely generally on the insurance industry as their main client. And then we have a standard that publishes the average retail market value for all makes and models for at least 5 years so that you're getting a source that is comprehensive. So that's the intent, to start with a fairly simple source. There are a couple insurers doing this today that go up on the web just like a consumer would and value the car in a fairly simple, straightforward way from that website and then use that as a starting point for their own valuation. That's what this bill is intended to do. In the next section, Section 3, the bill requires the insurer, once they've gone through that process, to disclose that valuation to the consumer. It doesn't require them to be bound by it, but it does require them to disclose it. Some people in my office have pointed out that if this bill were to pass, it may need some tweaking, presumably in the Senate side, if we're out of time on the House side, to make it clear in Section 3 that the valuation there has to be based on sources described in Section 2. Apparently that's not absolutely clear, but that is the intent. Then in Section 4, the insurer or the claimant is allowed to rebut that number that came from the published source. This means that insurers can use whatever other sources they want beyond this source once they've disclosed the public source to the consumer. It could be up. Insurers will point out, I think, today that oftentimes those public sources give low values. They are absolutely entitled under this bill to say, we gave you that public source number, but we'd like to give you a higher number. And I think common sense would tell you, in those cases, the insurers would be benefited by this bill because they would say, here's the required number that the state asked us to give you, but, by the way, we want to give you more. That would be an advantageous situation for the insurer. I think what the insurers are concerned about is the opposite case where they say, that's what we're required to give you off a public source, but for some reason we don't think that's a fair valuation. We think yours should be lower. They'd be entitled to do that, but they then have to explain why the public source wasn't a fair source. So I think the real issue here is why not start with a public source, and then if the insurer does have good evidence to rebut that, they can do so. Same with the consumer. They can rebut the number that comes from that public source. Finally, in Section 5 of the bill, it provides for some additional consumer rights. When there's communication about a total loss, there should be notice of our consumer complaint line, both the phone number and the website, so people know where to go if they have a consumer complaint, and then have require the insurer to describe what the various options are for dispute resolution. We're not changing any of the other options for dispute resolution under the bill. Those differ depending on the circumstance. They would all stay in place, but Section 5 says disclose in a careful way to the consumer what those are. So that's a short summary of the bill. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions from the committee? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just can't help but
mention what a pleasure it is to have a chair who's fair and kind and
beautiful
for a change.
Okay.
Sorry. I hope that doesn't get back to anybody.
So recorded.
I'm glad you're here. Again, I don't know how you have time to go to your office, but we appreciate you being here. I don't have the bill file on this because we have too many bills. It seems to me, the thing I remember about this was that we being the committee, were hoping for more data about this bill from the division. Do we have that since we first talked about this?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I believe we did in our first testimony provide the data that we had on the issue at our office. There was some suggestion that that data was not in keeping with some national data, and I didn't get a chance to come up and rebut, but the national data that was cited is based on data provided by our office, and so it shouldn't be inconsistent with it. There is no national database independent of our database, so I'm not quite sure why there was this claim that there was national data different than the state data, but I can assure you there is no national data available that doesn't come from the state.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
Yes.
So data that we got, whenever the day was of the first hearing, is the data we should go by in terms of from your office?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes, in terms of consumer complaints. Now, I got to be careful here. Obviously, there's a lot more data that a lot of people have about different aspects of the issue and so forth. But in terms of how many consumer complaints that we get in our division, we do track that. We gave those statistics at the first hearing, and those are the accurate statistics.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Oreo, could you tell me if you believe my statement is true or not? This bill preempts any local valuation.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, preempts
any local Oregon-based appraisal value, because we're having to rely on NADA or somebody else.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, in developing that first number, that disclosure, yes, that would be dependent on a national database that had broad sources of information. That, by the way, is the way it's done today. It's just done with services that are essentially beholden to the insurance industry as their major client. So that's the difference here. But in the second part of the bill, after that number has been developed, then the bill is wide open, just as current law is, about what sources can be used to rebut that original number. That would include the ADP and CCC, and it would include any local source, dealer quotes, and so forth.
Yes. I have to I guess express my disappointment in this Stash 1 amendment to proceed, but wouldn't it be possible to keep the committee that we already have and work through this rather than us all of a sudden impose this directly? I'm questioning if the Department of Consumer Business Services should be the one determining what valuation process is used. And I'm hoping you'll agree with me so that we could leave this with the committee to resolve rather than us arbitrarily decide.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not quite sure who the committee is in your question. This committee, is that what you're referring to?
No, it was my understanding we had a task force there that was studying this and trying to come up with something that was mutually beneficial. Am I wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, we have our own internal look at this issue, which could culminate in an advisory committee, and that is the process that we were on. I should be, again, clear. We're here today to support this bill that we worked on with Representative Buckley, but we originally did not bring a bill on this topic because we were working through it at the division level and develop these solutions as potential solutions in response to legislative interest. We believe this would improve the process, but again, if the legislature were not to pass this bill, and I think you're going to hear competing arguments about it, we would still go forward through our advisory process.
Other questions? I have one. Mr. Oreo, under the Dash 1 amendments, How many choices will there be under Section 2?
Madam Chair, we believe there are at least three today, the three I mentioned. Kelly Blue Book, again used primarily by the banks, the NADA source, there's an auto dealer website and public source, and then Edmunds. Those are the three. I think if you talk to the average consumer, probably people on this committee have this experience. If you're buying or selling a car these days and you want to check out values on the web, those are the three that are that get the most hits, that are used the most commonly by the public.
Thank you. And then one more. I guess this is a comment.
I'll follow up myself.
Because sometimes people read these literally because they're statutes. In Section 2B, it states it has to be a source that publishes the average retail market value for all makes and models for each of the last five model years and the listing and price, et cetera. And I hope it means to say for at least each of the last five model years, so that, for example, you wouldn't exclude sources that published for 6 or 7 or 8 years.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct, and it could be clarified in the bill that way, too, because as you point out, I mean, statutes are meant to be read literally.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We also have some people here to talk about the Dash 1 amendments. Diane, is it Klund?
Yes.
And Steve Morrell, please. And while they're coming forward, I wanted to say that we have, I hope everyone has something from David D. Merritt, General Counsel, Information Services, Inc., and that is in our files and will be added to the record on this case, or on this bill, sir.
4 hours. In
I know, I wasn't here for 4 hours. Thank you for being here.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, again, my name is Steve Merle. I'm an attorney with State Farm Insurance Companies. I just want to do a couple things, maybe kind of remind the committee of some of the testimony we had before and the context of this. Today, total losses are settled pursuant to an insurance division rule that attempts to establish the market value of the particular vehicle being valued. And it has a whole process of doing that. That Ms. Klund's company provides one of the services that does that, and she can kind of explain the process it goes through. But it starts with the insurance company inspecting the vehicle, finding out the relevant information, inputting it into their database, and then looking at it and trying to get it to where you have a particular value for the vehicle that is being involved valued. Even with the insurance division's numbers, even though there's a disconnect between what was Mr. Chartrand said the NAIC had and what was kept locally here, even with those numbers, 99% of the vehicles valued today go through the system and are settled without a complaint. And so this is a problem that, if it is a problem, maybe it's really a solution in search of a problem. It doesn't mean there aren't complaints, doesn't mean there aren't issues, but it means there's a high degree of success using the current system that we have. I'm going to just point out a couple things that I feel like you could probably tell from the bill. Subsection 4 of Section 2 basically says you're going to give a person a value of the book, and then you're going to fight about whether that value is right or not. That's a bad process. That's not healthy for my customers. It's not healthy for us to go through that kind of process. I think if you stay with objective criteria of really trying to tell what a person's car is worth and trying to sell it for that, and that's what the current process does, you're going to be much better off. This looks like, to me, a way to generate disputes, and I don't think that's what this committee wants to have happen. The other thing that I'm sure that the insurance division will tell you they would address in rulemaking, but the rulemaking won't solve it, is even within books like NADA, Blackwell, Kelly, there are the books that are sold at Walmart that the consumer buys and the books that the dealers have, and they don't mesh. And so you're going to end up with different information from what people think are the same source, and that's going to be even more of a dispute. If you go onto Kelly's website, which is another alternative, or NADA's website, both of those have consumer evaluations that they allow people to have free. That's different than what the dealer's evaluation would read. I think if you go down this track, the 1-800 number is going to get a lot of use, and there are going to be a lot more complaints. With that, I'll let Ms. Klund talk or handle questions depending on the committee's desires.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from Ms. Clunn and then take questions. Is that okay?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to expand on Mr. Murrell's comments, again, this bill still doesn't address the value of a consumer who lives in Oregon, the value of their car in Oregon, where they're presumably going to replace their vehicle. If you start with a national guidebook and you use that as the point of reference, it doesn't address issues like aftermarket parts and canopies on trucks, things that consumers do to build up the value of their vehicle. As I testified to at the last hearing, we have national call centers, as a matter of fact, here in Milwaukee, Oregon. Because people drive cars in Oregon, we know Oregon values on cars. And yes, there are going to be some cases where a consumer's car might be lower than what NADA is looking for or what NADA says the value is, and there are going to be some vehicles that are higher. The point is it has nothing to do with the consumer's vehicle. Our service, as well as other services that provide summer valuations, start in the area that the consumer lives in. We start with the zip code. We find actual vehicles. If you look at an NADA book, it'll tell you right in the front, this is an opinion of dealerships and what they think a car might ask for in a dealership lot and a national value. I also wanted to point out, for good reason, there is not another state in the United States that requires an insurance company to start a value with a book value. They open the door to book values in some states, but there are 9 states that specifically prohibit using a quote-unquote book value because they know it's not a local market value. So, again, there's no other state that specifically requires it, and I think there's a good reason for that. The NADA book is based out of McLean, Virginia. It's a national book. It's not going to address local values.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Riley.
Yeah, I wanted to pursue the statement that the consumer book is different than the dealer book. Why?
Chair, I want to meet you, Representative Riley. I really don't know why. I just know they have different books and they have different values. In fact, if you just want to go back to your office on the website, you'll find a consumer value that will show you a lower value than what Kelley Blue Book for the dealer would have. And that's just how those businesses have chosen to handle their business. Maybe Ms. Clunn would be able to answer that better. I don't know.
No, but I've just been informed that a colleague of mine has an answer to why there are two different books. If we wanted to
please
open
yes,
that up to Ms. Brady.
That would be a helpful piece of information. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Kelly Brady. I'm the product manager for Audit Texas Auto Source Vehicle Valuation Services, and thank you. What NADA does is it's economical, it's inexpensive, but what they do a national-only quarterly publication for consumers. It's a very inexpensive way to get name recognition in the marketplace. They do it quarterly, lags about 3 or 4 months behind the marketplace. But that's what they put into the consumer market. It's easily distributed. The intent behind the NADA book is for dealerships to be able to loan and get values for loaning cars. They have a separate set of data where they're actually looking at cars, what they're selling for, you know, what they hope the banks will loan on. They put together a separate source that goes into NADA that's published monthly or in some cases quarterly, depending on if you're talking a new car, an old car, and they're using it on a business-to-business site, not consumer, for that purpose. So their purpose is very different from what the NADA book published for consumers. It's one's a guide, you know, in the marketplace. It's more of a reference point. One's for establishing values on trade-ins, things like that, in a car dealership. Two completely different sources. So that's the big difference. Does that answer your question?
I think it does, unfortunately.
Representative Polizio.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to think how to phrase this as succinctly as possible. So, for example, the value CCC value scope methodology or rating or I don't know how you refer to it. Valuation service. It's proprietary, correct?
I can't speak to the CCC method. I could just speak to AutoSource's method locally.
Well, I guess the question for me, if I could follow up.
Yes.
The crux of this seems to be, or at least a big part of it, is the degree to which this information and the methodology at arriving at the price or the valuation, the degree to which it is available to the public and open. In other words, I think that seems to be an important element. So I don't know if you could speak to that.
I can speak to that. When we produce an evaluation, and we do this, you know, in 50 states, our recommendation is, you know, the insurance company gives us the accurate description of the car. We use the local market area. In our evaluation product that we use, we recommend that the insurance carriers provide that to the consumer. It shows the cars in the local market, what we use to establish the value. So in essence, it's full disclosure. They can see the cars. They can see the local market area that was used. And it details and documents everything about the total loss, the year, the make, the model, the mileage. In most cases, all the conditioning, the refurbishment. It talks about all the aftermarket equipment. It's full disclosure, and that's what we are doing. To say that we're working solely for the insurance carriers is incorrect. We just offer auto bodies. We do it for shops. Because we are locally based, we provide this service to consumers. They come up to our office in Milwaukee. People can come in and say, hey, put an evaluation on my car. I want to know what my car's worth. I'm thinking about selling it. We do that also. So we are open to consumers, you know, if they want to bring their cars to us and have us inspect them, look at them, and evaluate them. So we're doing this across, you know, a wide marketplace. Yes, insurance is primary, but we're doing it across the board.
Is that true with all of the sources, valuation services, that it's the methodology, the specific methodology to arrive at the valuation is available to the consumer?
Chair Bonamici and Representative Galizio, I don't think anybody's here from CCC that can be able to speak, but if you look at the Insurance Division Administrative Rule, it actually has some criteria that all these valuation services have to meet. So to a certain extent, the Administrative Rule kind of dictates a lot of the methodology that's used. And it's one of these things that the rule and the service kind of hand in hand came to be at the same time. And that's been enforced for about 20 years now, and I've used it all during that time in the insurance industry, and I've seen it do nothing but get better. It's had real-world criticism, real-world feedback, because you don't want to have disputes with your customer, and that has forced this process to get better and better. So I think we're it is as good a point as we've ever been, but we won't ever stop trying to improve these products.
One more.
I think so the rule dictates most of the criteria. What percentage is followed by? I mean, you say yeah. Yeah. In other words, what more or less is used?
Chair Bonamici, Representative Gleason, I don't have the rule in front of you, but as I recall, what it does is it basically says it has to be like model year options, and also basically that you the concept either by rule or bulletin, I can't remember which, is you start in the zip code that the person lives in and go out from there to find your values. And that's the methodology that they follow. There's some proprietary things, I think, that are different between the two services, but by and large, the main guts of it is the rule points you the direction you have to go to determine the value.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Nelson, do you have one more question now?
Do
you want to save it for Mr. Merritt?
No, I'd like to ask Steve Hawthorne, are these women, thank you for being here. I guess I'm curious, how can somebody prepare books like this and not claim responsibility or act for the accuracy of it? Or it's amazing to me. How does this happen?
I'll let you guys go.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that's a very good question, because in the front of, for example, the NADA book, it does state that we do not, stand behind the values.
The validity of our figures. Right. It says it's specific. Kelly Blue Book says this is only a guide, that we will not defend the figures. So we've got these artificially or unsupportable. They're to sell books, but they don't have any credence behind supporting their figures. I think that's the main
emphasis there.
Let the buyer beware.
Right. Exactly. Caveat emptor.
I believe we have Mr. Merritt here, so if we can have you come up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. My name is David Merritt. I'm the General Counsel of CCC Information Services in Chicago. I understand that you've received the letter that I've provided. Obviously, at the time I drafted that, it was in reference to the original 2591. I think my comments, however, are applicable to the amendment as well. I know that Mr. Chartrand has been here on our behalf before. I won't take your time explaining in detail our methodology, but if you have any questions about it, I'd be glad to answer that. What I really wanted to stress were a couple of additional points that I think are important at this time. I think a very important fact is that Mr. Ario indicated that there is no silver bullet here, that there will always be complaints. So that I think that he is the person with the most expertise to speak to that. And so I think we need to recognize that, unfortunately, complaints in this area kind of is the nature of the beast. But I think it's also important to understand the magnitude of the complaints. Again, he indicated that it might be as many as 100 or more a year. I think we have about half of the market in the automated valuation service. And last year we did 22,500 valuations. So I think you need to look at the magnitude of the work that's being done here and then compare the number of complaints to that in an area where obviously there are always going to be complaints because of the subjective aspect of valuing cars. So I think that's important by way of perspective. Secondly, Mr. Arno used another term that I think we ought to really focus on here, which is transparency. What CCC does is provides a valuation report with each valuation. That report explains the methodology that was used. It shows the backup data that was used, the comparable vehicles in the local market that were used, and the adjustments that we made to those to equate them to the lost vehicle. And that's given in detail. And in fact, we get complaints that it's too long. But it's our attempt to make sure that all the data is presented. Now, in comparison to that, these guidebooks, you get one number. It's a number. And I don't know how one could argue that that's transparent when there's no indication where that number came from, and I'll speak to that in a minute. But I think you need to weigh those two. So when an insurance company is using our service and has that information available, they can provide it to the consumer. The consumer can look at it and say, I disagree with this fact. They can call up the dealer if they want. All the data is there for them to fully investigate this and determine really if this is a fair value or not. On top of that, CCC has a staff of settlement support people in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, who are available. And if they get a concern, they can do more research. They can answer questions. Where did this number come from? Why did you use this car and not this one? And that, in our view, is the best way to get to a fair result, is to have that information available and to allow for that exchange of information so that everyone's comfortable with the final result. The third thing I wanted to point out is largely the substance of the letter that I submitted. Again, with respect to these guidebooks, just a couple of tidbits I think are important. If you look at page 3 of my letter, in the middle of the page where I quote from the Kelly guidebook, it says, these values are the opinion of the staff and management of Kelly. So as opposed to what we try to use, which is objective, real-time, local data, you have some people working for Kelly who are putting forth their opinions. And then further in that block quote, it says, the retail value represents the dealer's asking price and is a starting point for negotiations. So by Kelly's own admission, this isn't what they think the car is worth. It's what they think a negotiation with a dealer would start at. Well, where does it end up? And they don't tell you that. But I think by virtue of that in and of itself, they're admitting that that's not the accurate value of that car. I won't repeat the rest of the comments that I've put in the letter with respect to these guides, because I think it's pretty evident that they themselves do not hold themselves out as being authoritative sources of vehicle valuations. The other thing I would point out, of course, is that once you get past 6 or 7 years in the guidebooks, you're looking at a nationwide book as opposed to what CCC provides, which is a local market valuation. And then finally, there's the question of being beholden to the insurance company. Again, our solution to that is to provide all the data and let people look at it. The National Auto Dealers Association, I think it's fair to say, is beholden to auto dealers, and I think they may have a vested interest in having values be a certain amount as well. On the other hand, obviously, we're oftentimes higher than that. So those are the most important points I wanted to make, and obviously, if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Merritt. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. three things I want to say before we get answers, because I don't want to keep asking for permission.
You could just ask one really long question.
I'm going to. And the subparts are, first of all, number of complaints, and this is maybe more of a comment than a question. The other two would be more questions. People keep talking about, you know, the number of complaints and using that to base whether we should do anything or not. And my opinion is that that's completely unimportant. What's really important is, are we doing the right thing for the consumers, whether they complain or not? Secondly, in the guidebooks that I've seen, there isn't just one number. There are numbers, and then there are additions and subtractions for options and condition and so on, just as you do. And thirdly, you say theirs is an opinion, yours is accurate. But when you finish and you put this out, don't you say, wouldn't you say that it's your opinion that what you've done is correct?
That's all.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I fully agree with your comment about the complaints. Obviously, we view the objective to be to provide an accurate valuation on the lost vehicle. As to the numbers, my comment was, while this book certainly allows for adjustments to account for options and mileage, although they don't for condition, there's no data supplied as to how that number was derived. It's a number in the book without the supporting backup. And then finally, I forgot your third point. I'm sorry.
Your opinion.
Right. In fact, 70% of the time, our values are done in an automated fashion based on the data. And in the remaining percentage of the times where human intervention is required, they're there to do those kind of tough valuations where there might not be as much data. But there isn't. It's the data is driving the result based upon the statistics that the system is based on. And it's not a projection, which is what the books are. It's a calculation based upon the data that we've collected.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Just one observation and a question. I mean, I appreciate the idea of automated. It's done in, you know, 70% are done in an automated fashion. But unless you've discovered something that we don't know about, there are probably humans involved in creating that automation. Your paying clients are insurance companies are your paying clients, correct?
For this product, they're large. We've had customers like district attorneys who need to value cars for crime severity issues. We've had banks as customers. We've had departments of insurance actually use our services. Car insurance companies are by far away our largest customer. Other services we sell to body shops. I think we have something like 300 body shop customers in Oregon alone. But that's correct. And largely that's a price point issue. Most we've looked at having a consumer product, but most people don't want to pay that price when you can go get a book off the shelf.
Any other questions? Representative Riley.
Just a final comment, if I may. If I had my preference, I would have a completely local evaluation where I can go and say, okay, what lot was that car on that you're comparing my car to? I want to see it. But transparency is extremely important. And I just want to make sure that one of the things we do here, whether we pass this bill or some other bill or no bill, is to make it clear that we want to continue to see improvements in transparency of this occupation.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions?
Can I make one last comment in response?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. CCC has a field staff of over 300 people who go to used car dealerships throughout the country, including Oregon, and inventory the vehicles, look at the cars, write down the options, get the price. That all gets fed into the data. They go to these lots twice a month, and that information then shows up on the report with the phone number and the dealer contact. So, again, that's where I think the transparency is provided by us in a way that isn't with guidebooks.
One final, again.
Go right ahead.
Second final. when you do these evaluations at the used car lots, what price do you use?
Depends on the dealership. If it's a one-price dealership, we use the price that's on the sticker. If it's a dealership that negotiates price, we sit down with the used car manager and say, what is a take price for these cars on your lot? And they then give us the extent below their list price that they would expect to sell that car for.
Okay.
And what we've done is some empirical research that shows that on average the take prices we get from dealers are about 8% above what cars actually sell for. So the experience shows the dealers still leave themselves some negotiating room when they give us that take price.
And you use the take price?
Yes.
Thank you.
Is that your final?
That's my final. Yes.
Thank you. I now close the work session on House Bill 2591 and open a work session on House Bill 3186.
I spent a year as a car salesman, too.
You did.
Quite a while ago.
Okay.
House Bill 3186, we have some -5 amendments. And here to discuss the amendments, we have Amy Farbel and John DiLorenzo. You coming up here together? That's a good sign. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here for the Metropolitan and for the Metro Family Housing Association. Amy Farber is also here with me, and in a very short period of time, the proponents of the bill and the former, former opponents of the bill, had an opportunity to caucus and to focus on what was really important to the proponents and what could be acceptable to the overall real estate community. And I'm happy to report that I think we have agreed upon an accommodation that does that. What we have done, essentially, and let me just review very quickly what we've stricken from the bill and then what we've substituted. By way of the amendments. First of all, Section 6 of the bill, which would have required converters to pay tenants three times the amount of the Section 8 rents, had been stricken. Section 7, which would have permitted local governments to enact ordinances that imposed requirements that went beyond those in the bill, have been stricken. Section 1.1d has been clarified. Section 1.4d has been clarified. Section 2, which would have required landlords to provide tenants access to the common areas that were undergoing rehabilitation, has been stricken, but substituted, therefore, has been a provision that requires landlords to ensure that tenants have ready and safe access to and from their individual dwelling units. The Section 10, which created the rebuttable presumption, has been stricken, but other language has been substituted for that. Now, what has been put back into the bill is more information which clarifies exactly what information must be contained in the notices. Section 2 provides that improvements or rehabilitation of the common elements take place only between the hours of 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. during the notice period. In addition, the landlord must assure that each tenant has ready and safe ingress and egress to and from their dwelling units, as I mentioned before. Section 3 will preserve the current preemption bill, current preemption law, which prohibits local governments from regulating rents in circumstances other than those which do not exceed the provisions in the bill. So they can all mimic the bill if they wish. Section 5 provides, however, during the 120-day notice period, that landlords may not raise the rents beyond that which is provided by the CPI, nor can they issue no-cause eviction notices. They can issue for-cause eviction notices. And then Section 6, which was Ian's and Amy's idea, and I compliment them on it because it was very imaginative and is one that we embrace, is a look-back provision, which is designed to make sure that landlords do not take steps to evade the law. And what it does is focus on the time in which the declaration is recorded, and then there's a one-year look back. And any tenant who has either received a rent increase that is in excess of the CPI during that year or has been issued a no-cause eviction can bring an action against the landlord if the tenant sustains the burden of proof showing that those steps were done in anticipation of evading the requirements under the bill. We think it's a very good compromise. I want to compliment the proponents on their imaginative solution, and just want to say that it has been a pleasure working with them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Anything to add?
For the record, my name is Amy Favre. I'm representing the Housing Alliance. And I'd just like to echo John's comments. We found common ground in this bill. We were able to hone in on the pieces, I think, that immediately most impact tenants who are displaced by condo conversion, strengthens the 120-day notice provision by eliminating no-cause eviction and rent increases beyond those John mentioned that are tagged to the CPI, also provides this one-year look-back period, which makes that 120-day notice meaningful. Some of the examples you heard during the hearing were of people who'd been forced to leave their units prior to even getting that 120-day notice. We believe this one-year look-back will address that. One other thing I wanted to add in the elimination of the preemption provision is that the status quo remains, and the status quo currently allows local jurisdictions to impose moving expenses if they wish, and so that remains unchanged under this bill.
Thank you very much to both of you. Representative DeLeon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a section there, Mr. DiLorenzo, you were talking about safe egress and
ingress.
When would it be safe to go in but not safe to come out?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, it would be safe to go in if a bulldozer was not parked right in front of the door, but if subsequently the bulldozer was parked in front of the door, it would have been safe to go in but no longer safe to come out.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Galizio?
I hope my question is not as bizarre as that one. All right. Section 6, Ms. Favre. The burden that Mr. DiLorenzo talked about in terms of the burden on the tenant, could you discuss that a little bit, and what is your take on that? It seems like a pretty quite a burden to prove in court.
We've discussed the idea, Representative Galizio, Chair Bonamici, we've discussed the idea of the rebuttable presumption with several of our legal aid attorney friends and came to the conclusion that the rebuttable presumption did not provide much additional protection for the tenants. Because if a tenant, when the rebuttable presumption was in place, then the burden would be on the owner to prove that the tenant didn't have a case. So in that example, then a tenant might bring a case against an owner, and then if the owner didn't do anything about it, they would win. But in almost all cases, the owner would provide some sort of evidence to the contrary, and then we're back in the same position we are in here. So we found that it was a provision that didn't add real extra protection to tenants, but alleviated some of the concerns of our opponents and allowed us to find common ground.
Madam Chair, my question is about, I'm sorry, follow up.
Yes.
I don't know. My question is about the new, right? You took out rebuttable.
I'm sorry. You're asking about
I'm sorry. It wasn't a clear question. I'm asking about now what is in this amendment.
This amendment, Representative Galizio,
you
Chair
feel okay with that?
Yeah. Yes, this actually amendment was our idea. Okay. We feel good about it. It triggers a one-year look back from the recordation of the declaration. So that means that if somebody is evicted for no cause, or let's say more than likely it would be an entire building was evicted for no cause, which is what's happening now, and then 2 or 3 months down the the line the owner starts condo conversion action, those tenants have recourse. They can sue for damages because they, if they can build the case that that owner evicted them for the purpose of avoiding the 120-day notice of period.
Right, and that, I guess that my question is, that seems like quite a burden in court. Am I, is that inaccurate?
Madam Chair, can I address that for a second?
Yes,
very difficult burden.
Madam Chair and Representative Galizio, actually, it all depends on the facts and the circumstances. If, for instance, there are memos in the developer's file that provide, let's issue our 30-day notices now so we don't have to have anyone to give 120-day notices to, that would be great evidence. There are all kinds of other ways in which tenants, especially if they are vacated en masse, would be able to establish clear inferences that that took place. On the other hand, all this does really is impose the same burden that any plaintiff would have. And so, you know, you have to show that it was done in order to evade the law.
And Representative Galizio, Chair Bonamici, Ann Slingerlin, who helped craft this compromise, has something to add if you'd like to hear.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Chair Bonamici, Representative Galizio, it is a burden for tenants. I think Ian Slinger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants. I think in practice where this is going to provide the most protection is in terms of self-help for tenants who are advocating for themselves. What we're seeing now is that tenants are, buildings are being cleared out all at once. Right now, tenants don't have a lot of options to challenge a landlord when that happens. This provides clear language in the law that that is a violation of the statute and creates penalties so tenants together can with or without an attorney, write their landlord and say, "This is a, we believe this is a condo conversion. It's a clear violation of the statute. Here's the penalties if you continue to move forward." And I think in many cases that that's happening now, this will address. If I mean, there may be cases where a landlord will try and get around this in other ways, and we'll see. And then it does create some burden for tenants, but this is a huge step forward for tenants.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Riley.
One thing that bothers me about what we just came up with, and I don't think it bothers me enough to vote against it, but is the fact that we did put preemptions in this bill. We preempted local communities from exceeding this. Is that correct?
Chair Bonamici, Representative Riley, we didn't add any preemptions. We maintained the status quo, so there's no additional preemptions as a result of this language.
Well, let me restate by what we did was take the lifting of the preemptions out of the original bill. Is that correct?
The original... Chair Bonamici, Representative Riley, the original bill had language that expressly gave local jurisdictions the ability to regulate condo conversions as long as the state, they met the minimum of the state guidelines. So that we did lose that from the bill. We didn't, in order to move forward and come to some consensus on common ground and provide significantly more protections for tenants, we did take that out, but we didn't lose anything from what the status quo was prior to the bill being introduced.
So just to clarify, in Portland, for example, where there exists a payment provision already, that will still be enforced. Is that correct?
They can still have that law. Right. Whether or not it will be enforced is up to the jurisdiction.
Correct. Representative Riley?
And that one was actually stated that the payment provision could stay. And again, this is because this is such a great bill, a great step forward, and I think we all agree with that. I'm gonna be a yes on this bill. I would prefer, and I just want to get on the record, I would prefer not to put preemptions on local jurisdictions of any kind if we can avoid it.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? I would entertain a motion on the Dash 5 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendments.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 5 amendments are incorporated into House Bill 3186.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3186
as amended to the floor of the do pass recommendation.
Representative Girard has moved House Bill 3186 as amended with the dash 5 amendments to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a comment to say nice job in putting this together. We appreciate it.
Can you get a corporate minimum?
Any other discussion? Can the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Galizio?
Aye. Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Belson? Aye. Vice Chair Bonamici? Aye. House Bill 3186 is amended. It's moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm going to offer that to Representative Shields to carry. And I close the work session on House Bill 3186 and open a work session on House Bill 2112. I'm going to ask Steve to go ahead and explain the amendments on House Bill 2112.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. House Bill 2112, the amendments before the committee are the dash 2 amendments. It is a complete, to use the common parlance, Dutton stuff. It has to do with zero lot line, or what's commonly referred to as row houses, which currently aren't subjected to any warranty provisions under the Condominium Act, and they're not considered, by definition from the bill that we passed out, 2657, they're not considered residential dwellings, but in fact people live in them and own them and the walls and everything. So it provides the same warranty provisions, the same requirements for CCB to develop educational material to be distributed by the contractors to the buyers about moisture intrusion and other problems with the building envelopes. It has standard contract terms in plain language. All this, again, was in House Bill 2657, which passed out of the committee relating to residential structures. It has a right to cancel the contract by midnight the next business day unless both parties agree that the work is to start immediately. And those are the provisions of 2112.
Thank you. And we did, committee, if you recall, we talked about this the other day, and because we had just received the amendments, we didn't move it. Does anybody have any concerns about this or questions we can follow up on?
Well, I have a question, if I may. Does the bill that we heard, which puts this group of houses, defines them in the residential grouping, where we did the two types of licensing, doesn't that cover this?
You know, Steve?
But could you restate the question so I'm sure I understand
the
question?
It's the contract bill.
Yeah, but the bill that the AGC brought to us, which defined the three types, the residential, the small commercial,
right,
and the commercial. These types of houses were listed in that bill under residential, and I believe that we already have a bill which covers residential. So if we pass both of those bills, isn't this then covered?
Representative Girard has
I honestly don't think so.
Okay.
And I'm not trying to... I know what you're talking about, but that's existing language that's in the bill right now. And what happened is the bill that we passed that actually was a no vote on left this out. And so Representative Holby was concerned.
Right.
And so if I had my druthers, we'd pull the other bill back, add this to it, and be done and make it simple. But that's...
Right.
Could I... Get a response from
right. we're going to call somebody to explain this, hopefully.
For the record, my name is Tamara Brickman, legislative coordinator for the Oregon Building Codes Division. I understand that this is necessary, and this is based on conversations, and you'll have to, and I can follow up for sure on this, that this is necessary because of the way residential residences are defined in CCB. Currently, it applies to four units or less. And so if you have zero lot line homes that have more than four, then you need to include this, and you have to have this bill in order to cover those zero lot line or row house type entities.
Okay. And I agree that we would have, if we hadn't just passed the bill we did, which hasn't passed the full House and the Senate, so,
right.
So yeah.
Right. So it's my understanding that this will just include those in the bill that we've already passed, and then they can do all the conforming magic that they do later on down.
I'm not sure which bill you're talking about. Is that the House Bill 3242, the big AGC bill?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not familiar with the provisions of that bill.
Yeah.
So.
It's not passed. Any questions or concerns? Entertain a motion on the dash 2 amendment.
Are you in work session? I didn't hear you.
Yes, she did.
I did.
She
okay.
Did.
Are we in work session? Did she?
Yes.
I didn't hear it. I'm sorry.
I did. Sorry. You didn't hear your name. Yes, I would entertain a motion on the dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2112.
Thank you, Representative Nelson has moved the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2112. Any discussion?
I just want to make it clear that I'm going to give a courtesy yes. I promise that to the chair. Yes.
Thank you.
I reserve the right to vote against it on the floor.
Thank you, Representative Durad. With that, the dash 2 amendments are incorporated into House Bill 2112.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2112 with the dash 2 amendments to the House floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Nelson has moved House Bill 2112 with the dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I, too, Madam Chair, would like to express that I'm doing this as a courtesy, not because he asked me, but because of my previous comment about him when he wasn't here.
Perfect.
And I reserve the right as well.
Your right is hereby reserved.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Can the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Galizio? Aye.
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Durad?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
I always reserve the right to vote differently on the floor, and I vote aye.
Representative Nelson?
Yes, without any complications.
Vice Chair
Bonamici? Aye. House Bill 2112 with the dash 2 amendments is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Anybody volunteer to carry this? Representative Holby.
Beautiful.
Always do. That's
oh,
your wedding. More important.
Thank you. I now close the work session on House Bill 2112, and I'm going to carry over the following: House Bill 2621, House Bill 2621, House Bill 2002. House Bill 3107, House Bill 3284, House Bill 3077, House Bill 3321, House Bill 3242, House Bill 2568, and House Bill 2591.
No.
And I'm closing the
2672.
Yes. Closing the. I'm closing the Committee on Consumer Protection.